Case number 12-7135, AF Holdings, LLC versus Does 1 through 1058, Pops Communications, Inc. et al. Appellants. Mr. Fox for the appellants, Ms. McSherry for amici curiae, and Mr. Duffy for the appellee.
Counsel, may I suggest you raise the, you can raise the whole thing. There's a button.
Thank you, Your Honor. Much better. May it please the Court, my name is Ben Fox, and I'm appearing here for Verizon Online, Cox Communications, and Bright House Networks. Now, this is a fast-developing area of law. We've seen in the last 20 months that district courts across the country have overwhelmingly adopted a set of rules that have required plaintiffs in these types of cases to file single-Doe defendant complaints as a prerequisite to obtaining discovery from the Internet service providers. We have seen the courts deal with the volume of these cases by coordinating them before a single district judge per district, and that process has yielded thorough decisions by the Eastern District of New York and Patrick Collins and adult film cases, by Chief Judge Gwynn in the Northern District of Ohio in the Safety Point case, and by district courts in California, Illinois, Oregon, Washington, all of which are cited in our briefs. Now, granted, the district court did not have the benefit of those decisions when she issued her order. But what was clear in the record below and what is clear in the record here is that the lawsuits filed by AF Holdings and the companies that are affiliated with it very rarely reach their merits because they do not result in the complaints being served and defendants being named even after the Internet service providers respond to the subpoenas. Now, at least two conclusions should follow that fact. Conclusion number one, the time is at the outset of this case or never to resolve the threshold legal issues of personal jurisdiction, venue, and joinder. The defendants are not appearing. The time to do it is at the outset. The second conclusion is that in weighing the need for the personal information of hundreds or thousands of subscribers in a single suit against the burdens that these cases impose on ISPs, the burden is necessarily undue, and that is as a matter of law.
Let me ask you a question. You started out by saying that these plaintiffs don't, these cases rarely go to trial, right? Suppose they had actually used this geolocation technology and sued and sought only the names of the 20 customers living in the district. And suppose also that there was some evidence that those 20 had downloaded this file at about the same time, you know, on the joinder issue. It really wouldn't make any difference, would it, that in other cases they hadn't gone to trial? Wouldn't they be entitled to that discovery?
Well, I would say that would be a closer case than the case that we have here. But one would also need to assume a proper plaintiff.
So the problem then isn't their past, the fact that these don't go to trial. The problem, as I understand it from your brief, is that the overwhelming number of customers here don't live in the district, right? Isn't that the point that you're
that
making?
Is a venue problem and a personal jurisdiction
right.
problem. That is not addressing the joinder problem.
Well, let me ask you a question and follow up. Oh, excuse me. Go ahead.
Yeah, but isn't that the core of your argument here about personal jurisdiction and venue? Is that they're seeking information. This is what I thought your argument was. They're seeking information that really wouldn't be of any value here because most of these people can't be sued here. Right?
Yes. And They are seeking information that we know from the record at page 103 to 105 of our appendix. They filed 118 of these multi-dose suits. Okay. Not one of them has resolved. Not one of them has even resulted in a subscriber.
May I take you, what Judge Taylor is focused on is the joinder issue. Suppose you had located the 20 people in the District of Columbia who had, at least you had an IP, that would, you don't know that they individually had done it, but you had an IP that located those 20 people. Would you, not your argument still, it is not the same transaction?
Yes,
because there's no showing that they in any way cooperated on this?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you would still be arguing strongly there's no joinder?
Yes, because the Rule 20 for joinder requires that all of the defendants participate in the same transaction or same series of transactions. And we think that the law is now clear that just being accused of downloading the same film at different times during a four-month period using a protocol that does not require or even permit the subscribers or defendants, and our position is that they're not the same, but doesn't require them to know or have any connection with one another. That is misjoinder.
It's not the usual case that a third party responding to subpoena raises joinder issues. Is there any procedural problem with your being here and being in court on this?
These cases are unusual. True. Now, we have standing because the Internet service providers were subpoenaed. Yeah. They did not come to this fight. The fight was brought to them.
Do you have standing to raise that issue of joining?
We do, Your Honor, because this is pre-Rule 26 discovery. We're under Caribbean Broadcasting and other authority. The court needs to undertake a good cause analysis.
Your standing is the same for joinder as it would be for personal jurisdiction. If you have standing for one, you have standing for the other. And if you don't have standing on one, you don't have standing on the other.
I agree. The grounds and the argument is the same.
And if we were to agree with you on your point about personal jurisdiction and venue, would we have to even deal with joinder? In other words, if they're not entitled to discovery to find personal jurisdiction. Doesn't that end the analysis from your point of view?
Well, our view is that if this case goes anywhere from this court, it should go back with directions that the plaintiff can proceed only on a single DOE defendant basis.
Which means we have to reach the joinder question.
I think on personal jurisdiction, that alone probably doesn't get to a single DOE mob. Yes.
Yes, I understood that. Now, what about the burden question? Your burden here is really not economic, is it?
It is not entirely economic, but there is a cost to the ISPs in responding to the subpoenas.
And what is it besides economic?
It is illustrated in the Northwestern Memorial Hospital case from the Seventh Circuit, which recognized that publicity, that recurring burdens, and that other adverse ill effects, such as complaining subscribers, who in many cases are innocent of any infringement, that those are things that adversely affect
Did
Internet
you make
service providers.
A showing of burden below?
In my view, we made an amply sufficient showing of burden to allow
Can
us
you
to
tell attend. Me what evidentiary showing, if any, on burden you made?
Yes, Your Honor. We had declarations from Verizon, from AT&T, from Bright House Networks, from Comcast. They have showed that a substantial amount of time was devoted to responding to these subpoenas, and that in some cases customers are complaining, and it's causing problems with ISPs. And these subpoenas are, in many instances, taking precedence over law enforcement subpoenas and other tasks that these employees should be doing with their time. Just a couple of other points. Article 3, federal courts resolve live cases.
I just want to go back to your answer to Judge Sullivan. You said you want an order saying this can only go discovery can only go plaintiff by plaintiff, or doe by doe, right?
We believe that that is the rule.
But isn't the only question before us whether the discovery order the district court issued, I mean, wouldn't we just, if we agree with you, wouldn't we just vacate that?
The court certainly can reverse and send it back with no direction, certainly.
Right. Okay. Good. What were you about to say about the Constitution?
Unless the court has questions, I won't address at this time the issue about AF Holdings and the fake Alan Cooper signature.
Go ahead.
On the role of federal courts, courts, as I understand it, resolve live cases and controversies. Courts typically do not assist plaintiffs in compiling what is essentially a mailing list or a telephone list to send out demands for settlements. This is what this case presents. The record is now clear on that. Unless the court has
questions. As I said in my first question to you, if they had used the geolocation device and only sought information about the people who live in the district, there wouldn't be anything wrong, would there, of them seeking discovery to get the names of people to send letters to for settlement purposes, would there?
Yes, there would be something.
Assume also that the copyright is perfectly legitimate. I mean, assume the facts are this is a blatant violation of the copyright laws. These people are violating the copyrights. They're only seeking information about people in the district. That's not appropriate discovery? Of course it is.
In the ordinary case, that may be appropriate discovery. But on this record, this is a case where the complaint has not before been used to name defendants and serve them. And that affects necessarily the good cause analysis under Caribbean Broadcasting.
Okay.
Thank you. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
No, I think your amicus is scheduled next. So why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Corinne McSherry, and I'm here on behalf of AMICI Electronic Frontier Foundation, the ACLU, the ACLU of the nation's capital, Public Citizen, and Public Knowledge. And I want to start by thanking you for allowing us to participate in this argument today. Our organizations got involved in this case, as we have in many other similar cases around the country, because we're committed to the idea that the legal process should be fundamentally fair. And we perceived from early on that this process was fundamentally unfair. And so early on, we really intervened almost on behalf of the does to try to speak for them. We realized that this process was fundamentally unfair, and we're very happy to see that so many district courts now agree with us. And we're hoping
What about the question as to whether joinder is an appropriate ground for us to reverse the district judge as opposed to personal jurisdiction, or should we reach both as alternative holdings?
You should reach both, Your Honor.
It's joinder that troubles Judge Tatel, so you should address yourself. Maybe Judge Santel, too. I don't know.
Absolutely. So the reason you need to, or the courts should reach the joinder issue early on are twofold. One is because there's a general duty in our procedural rules to avoid undue burden and fundamental unfairness, and several courts have been realizing this. So the plaintiff has a duty to design discovery that is not fundamentally unfair, and a court has a duty to enforce that. And that's why, for example, we have requirements for early discovery that the plaintiff show a good faith belief that this discovery is going to be fruitful and going to be appropriate. When you join together 1,000 people at once,
now what about the 20 people in the District of Columbia? It's easy with 1,000 people. What about the harder question, the 20 people in the District of Columbia?
Even if you have the 20 people together, joinder is still improper because you can't show that they are engaged in the same transaction and occurrence. You might think of this a little bit like a poker table at a casino. Over the course of the night, many different people may come to that table and play. And even some of the money from the first person might be passed on to the third, fourth, tenth person down the line, but that doesn't mean that those people are related for purposes of engaging in some sort of unauthorized activity. That's exactly how it works with BitTorrents. The way it works is that those 20 people aren't necessarily related. They aren't necessarily involved in the same transaction, particularly here where they're very distant in time.
Suppose it all occurred during the same, what's that phrase?
Swarm.
Well, I mean, as I understand it, when one person is online with the video, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's at that point that other people can download portions of that video. That's what BitTorrent does, correct? Takes bits of that from everybody who's online or who's made his video available and takes it from that, right?
Well, that's the latter point. The original person doesn't have to be online anymore.
No, he just has to make it available, right?
Correct.
Okay, cause, I mean, is that right? You can, if you want to participate in this, you can either download the film and go off and watch it, or you can somehow indicate that it's available for other people, correct?
Well, actually, it's made available automatically once the process is complete. Right. But what you can't know is whether ex-defendant actually got any data or any meaningful amount of data for any other ex-defendant. And actually, I probably shouldn't use the word defendant because we don't have defendants here, right? We have IP subscribers, and we know that many of them are going to be innocent because all you know from the IP address is whose name is on the bill.
Nor do you know whether the first person who's online has any intention to distribute.
Right.
You don't have there's no showing at all that the first person who is online mm-hmm. has any intention to distribute to anybody else through the Bitcoin process.
And what you also know
is... Am I correct?
Yes.
Unless you have some allegation that there's a intentional way in which the first person wishes to be a seed.
Well, unless you want to assume that people who use BitTorrent automatically are buying into a whole host of other intentions, which is, I think, a pretty big assumption to make. You can't assume that. And what you definitely don't know is that ex-defendant has no idea who else might be engaging in acquiring the file. So there's no relationship between these people other than that they use the same protocol to acquire the same work. And court after court has said that is not enough.
As I read your brief, I thought your real interest in being here is your interest in what you call the right to anonymous internet communication, right? Isn't that what you talk about in your brief a lot?
We talk about it somewhat. Mm-hmm. It is part of what's important. I think I want to reiterate our fundamental interest here is making sure we have a level playing field for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
That is really what we're most above all committed to.
Mm-hmm.
Safeguards for privacy and free speech are part of that. And our concern with the district court's opinion is that, unlike actually some of her earlier opinions, she simply ignored the First Amendment test altogether. And that strikes us as inappropriate. That needs to be part of the balancing.
But is there, let's assume for purposes of argument, that they're violating the copyright. Are there any First Amendment issues there?
Well, it is certainly true that the First Amendment does not protect
right.
copyright infringement. We know
so
that.
So there is no right to anonymously download copyrighted information, correct?
What the First Amendment requires uh-huh. is that if there's a speech implicated, which many courts have agreed, including this court, that there is involved in downloading even copyright infringing works, then you need to apply a balancing test. Now, it may be that test is easily passed,
uh-huh.
but it needs to be applied. And that is our position.
Okay. Thank you.
Finally, Your Honor, I just want to make one final point. Several courts, particularly recently, this goes to the issue of burden and undue burden. Several courts have realized that part of the process for the court in evaluating motions for early discovery is to consider not just the burden on the ISPs, but the burden on the subscribers. And I would urge you to consider that as well. Again, it's part of our procedural safeguards are not just for the immediate targets of the subpoena, but a plaintiff has a duty to avoid an undue burden to any person. And I would suggest to you that the record of
these
cases...
What case says that?
That's in Rule 45.
Mm-hmm.
Rule 45 D3. You must quash a subpoena where there is an undue burden to a person. And I think that that's, again, just implicit in our discovery.
You don't think the person is the recipient of the subpoena?
I'm sorry?
You don't think the person is the recipient of the subpoena?
Well, I think the primary burden is to the uh-huh. recipient of the subpoena, but I think that it is also incumbent upon the plaintiff and the courts to consider whether there are additional
burdens. I wasn't disagreeing with you that it sounded yeah. interesting. I was just wondering whether anybody's actually ruled that. Is there a case that says that?
Yes, there are. Judge Wilkins said this in Millennium versus uh-huh. One of the Millennium cases.
Who said that?
And in the, Judge Wilkins?
Judge Wilkins? Well, yeah, he's now on the D.C. Circuit, but did any circuit court say that?
No, there is no circuit court that says that, Your Honor. But nonetheless, I think it is true.
What part of Rule 45 again?
So if you look at it under 45A, they focus on burden to the subpoena recipient, and that's appropriate. But 45D.
Now, what are you coming to? Give me the one that you are relying on.
Yes, so 45D3.
45D3.
Says that a court must quash a subpoena where there's an undue burden to a person. And that is not necessarily even specifically cited by the district courts who have looked to the undue burden to subscribers,
but several of them have. Excuse me, do you have authority from any court? Do you have authority from any court that extends that to somebody like a subscriber?
Yes. Let's see. I know in the Millennium versus TGA.
You mean Judge Wilkins's opinion?
Judge Wilkins, and in the Safety Point case, he also focused on the burden to subscribers. Hmm. So that is something that courts have felt that they needed to consider, particularly as the record of these cases has been developed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Paul Duffy. I'm the attorney for the Appley AF Holdings. I want to start off. First of all, I wanted to address.
Are you only the attorney, counsel?
Yes, I'm only
the. You're not a principal at all?
I'm absolutely not a principal.
You're not going to take the fifth on that question?
No, I will not.
Who are the principals?
There's a chairman, the CEO, is a person named Mark Lutz, who lives in Miami, Florida.
Are the attorneys on these cases also principals?
No, they're not.
Well, how come one of your co-counsel took the fifth in the Ninth Circuit on that?
I believe that was a personal decision. During that hearing, the president and CEO of AF Holdings was there, prepared to testify, and wasn't allowed to be presented as a witness at that hearing. I want to address the issue of joinder initially. I disagree somewhat with the. There has been substantial case law on who properly is joined.
Would you start with jurisdiction?
I'm sorry?
I'd rather have you start with jurisdiction.
Well, in this case, in a case like this, we have a series of internet protocol addresses that were observed participating in the same swarm. And I believe the evidence at the hearing and in the papers.
Well, no. Let's talk about jurisdiction. The defendants say, look, there's really no evidence that is it very only possibly very few of the John Does you're seeking information about even live in the district?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part.
No. The defendant's argument is that there's no evidence that any of these John Does live in the District of Columbia and can be sued here.
Well, we don't have.
That's their first argument.
We don't have information on where any of them live.
What we do know is three of the ISPs you've subpoenaed tell us in their affidavits that they don't even have any D.C. customers. So what do you do about them?
Well, it's not really possible. They also recommend the use of geotracing or geotechnological tracing of these individuals, which is highly inaccurate. It can identify.
I just got curious about it when I read in the brief. I tried a half a dozen of them, and they didn't, by the way, cost me anything. You can do them online. And I tried a bunch of names, and they came up in Des Moines and Oklahoma City, and then I tried myself and a couple of my colleagues, and we all came up in Washington. So it seemed pretty accurate to me.
Now, some of them can be accurate. Some of them are also inaccurate. But our position is that it's premature.
But if back to the part about some of the ISPs, three not having any customers.
None.
Can you answer that without changing? Speak to that without changing the subject.
If there was an ISP, which we don't know going in, but if they identified all three individuals that they had as being in Washington, we would likely bring a lawsuit. Washington State, we would likely not bring a lawsuit there. If not here.
Using the discovery here to produce information to sue people in other districts.
Mm-hmm. In part to sue.
What do you say about Oppenheimer?
I'm sorry.
What do you say about Oppenheimer on that subject? When the purpose of a discovery request is to gather information for use in proceedings other than the pending suit, discovery properly is denied.
Well, it's also for use in connection with this suit.
I'm sorry, counsel, I can't hear you.
It's also for use in connection with this suit as well. We're also seeking discovery in connection with individuals in this suit. Personal jurisdiction, obviously, is an affirmative defense that a defendant may or may not choose to assert. It's not something that's required to be established in a complaint. And a defendant may choose not to assert a personal jurisdiction defense.
Should ignore the statement you just made about arguments. There's some of them somewhere else if you got that information.
I'm saying it's possible we sue if the results were solely for show that the people live solely in a specific state. The client would probably pursue if he named those individuals as defendants in those states. But the key was in this was to sue as many people in this jurisdiction as possible. And if they chose to raise it as an affirmative defense, they could. In a lot of instances, they might not want to. I mean, if an individual would rather see what a group does in connection with defending a lawsuit rather than defending it individually, he may choose to waive it as an affirmative defense, and it wouldn't be an issue in connection with the lawsuit moving forward.
The ISPs tell us in their brief that the signature, the Alan Cooper signature on the copyright assignment is forged. And you didn't respond to that in your brief, I don't think. Did you?
That was not an issue that was raised at the district court level at all.
But you didn't respond to it here.
We didn't respond to it here.
Because they argued here that that's an independent basis for dismissing the case.
And we did file a note when that allegation was made. We filed a notice with this court and for other courts for which AF Holdings had a presence of the allegations of the individual alleging that, but our position is that that's not
a basis. You filed what?
I'm sorry,
what did you say you filed?
I filed a notice of those allegations with this court saying that the individual, Mr. Cooper, had repudiated his signature in connection with that transfer. But our position is it's not an independent basis to dismiss the case because it's not a necessary signature. As the district court in Minnesota found just 2 weeks ago in addressing the identical transfer of the identical copyright, that the Copyright Act requires a transfer to be done in connection with a writing signed by the assignor. It doesn't have any requirement the assignee sign it. So if, in fact, it were proven that signature is not valid, the district court in Minnesota at least found that to be an irrelevant fact and cited several other cases finding the same thing, that there's no requirement that a person sign to accept a copyright. All that's required is a signature to assign the copyright to somebody else, and then that copyright is filed with the Copyright Office. So it's our position that that's not an independent basis to dismiss the suit. And I don't know if it's in the record, but the U.S. District Court of Minnesota ruling issued March 31st, combined cases. I think it's 12-CV-1448 was the lead case in which the court found that, and several other courts have found with different assignments that it's not necessary to have an assignment accepting the assignment of a copyright. All that's necessary is a person giving it away sign that.
It doesn't make any difference that the name, even though not necessary, was forged.
I don't know if it was or not. There's a dispute uh-huh. between the person whose signature it is and various other people. I mean, he did testify in Minnesota, subject to cross-examination, and the magistrate issued a decision, and then the district court found that that it was immaterial, that there was no fraud upon the court based on that signature.
Uh-huh. Let me ask you another question. The ISP say in their brief that in 118 cases filed by plaintiff's counsel in the last 2 years, none had resulted in a defendant being served in the form. Is that accurate?
That's absolutely inaccurate. There have been many cases where defendants have been served. And in fact, many of the AF Holdings cases were filed against, this is an exception, many of them were filed against single individuals, and many of them were served with a complaint in connection with that matter, with those matters, rather. I don't know the number, but there are a substantial number of those.
Uh-huh. And would those be in the record here?
I don't know if they're in the record. I can supplement the record with cases where that's happened.
You're a member of the D.C. Bar.
Yes.
Right?
And, yes.
Okay. And you're telling us that this statement's false.
That statement's false. I know specific cases that I represent at AF Holdings where they were served with process. And some of them were litigated to some extent. In some cases, the defendants won dismissal of the cases. Mm-hmm. I believe there are a couple of those in California.
Are there any cases in which you prevailed?
In terms of default, there are cases in which we have obtained default judgment.
Nothing's gone to final litigation?
No, not any cases that I have handled. There was in Pennsylvania, Bellwether, case where a judge ordered a case to go to trial, and the plaintiff, and a very similar type of complaint, the plaintiff succeeded when a substantial substantial judgment in connection with that case. But none of the AF Holdings cases have gone to trial.
So let me just go back to basics with you for a minute and make sure I understand your position. Okay, do you agree that it's 26B1 that governs this, namely? For good cause, court may order discovery of any matter relevant to subject matter involved in the action, right? That's the question.
That's my understanding of the rule, yes.
Well, okay. So you agree that there has to be quote, good cause, right?
Yes.
For you to get discovery. It has to be good cause, and it has to be regarding any matter relevant to the action, right?
Yes.
Okay. So let's start once again with the three ISPs who say they have no clients, no customers in the district. How would there be good cause for action, any subject matter related to the action? It can't be that you might find information to sue someone in the state of Washington because it says any matter relevant to the subject matter in the action. So for the three ISPs who say they have no customers here, how could there possibly be good cause?
Good cause to obtain discovery? Well, that's information you find out after the discovery. The only way to find out if anybody's infringing on a copyright through a computer is to obtain the IP address.
They don't have any customer. They don't serve the District of Columbia.
I think they don't serve the District of Columbia.
That's what they're saying.
I don't know if we...
They say they don't have customers in the District of Columbia.
I don't know if that was something that was known when the subpoena was requested.
This is their opposition to the subpoena. These are their documents in effort to get the subpoena quashed.
But in the process of getting the subpoena, all we had was the IP address number. So in the process of getting it, I don't believe we knew that ISP did not serve any customers.
Okay, so now that you know those three don't have any customers in the district, do you agree that that has to be dismissed at that point?
I wouldn't object to it at that point, correct.
You wouldn't? Okay.
Right.
And now what about the others? Let's see. Comcast said they have one out of the 400 names you're seeking, one's in the district. Now, what do we do with that?
Well, we could do further investigation on the one and see if we could.
But you need all 400? So would we just say, okay, produce that one? Would that be okay with you? Not the other 399?
Well, we could still sue the other 399 in this district.
But the 399 aren't in the district. That's what they're telling him.
It would be subject to a personal jurisdiction.
It would be subject to what?
Defense again. I'm sorry?
It would be subject to what?
From the defense of lack of personal jurisdiction.
No. This is a motion. You're seeking discovery. This isn't a motion to dismiss. Mm-hmm. They're arguing that there's no good cause. And you just agreed with me that you have to show good cause and that it has to produce relevant information relevant to the case before us, right?
Right.
So of the 400, they say one. So the 399, just as you agreed that you wouldn't have any objection to dismissing the three internet providers who don't serve the district, I assume your answer is the same for Comcast with respect to the 399 that aren't in the district.
The 399 likely wouldn't be named as defendants in this case.
But why would they have to be? Why would Comcast have to produce the information? Why would they have to tell you that these 399 all live in Los Angeles or wherever they went?
Well, they should provide some basis to verify the accuracy of their complaint.
Well, this is, What complaint?
Why is that any different?
I'm sorry.
Why is that any different from your answer about the first three?
Yeah.
Well, we've learned enough information to verify that.
No, counsel, carefully. Now, listen carefully. You agreed that with respect to the three that have nobody in the district, you have abandoned any more claim for subpoena enforcement, right?
For subpoena enforcement.
Yes. So why isn't the same thing true of Comcast with respect to everybody but one address? There's no distinction.
Well.
So now you're down to one person, right? Or one. What is it called?
No, we've got 20 more here. We've got Verizon.
No, I'm talking about for Comcast.
Oh, for Comcast. Yeah, Verizon has. Let's get all the numbers out. Verizon says they have 118 subscribers. You're seeking 118. They only have 20 in the district. So of the 1,000 plus John Does you're seeking information on, three of the Internet service providers say they don't serve the district all, and the other two say they only have 20 customers.
21.
21. Thank you. So would you agree then that it has to be, the subpoena has to be quashed with respect to all 1,000, all except for the 21?
I'm sorry, all 20.
All except
for the 21.
I don't know if it'd have to be quashed. I mean, I believe the court had an order suggesting that they provide the states where these individuals were located, but not their identities. So in that case, I don't know if it would be quashed or not.
But why would
the states be relevant if they're not in the District of Columbia?
Yeah.
What is the difference whether it's Hawaii, state of Washington, or Utah?
Well, to give us some way of confirming the accuracy of the information we're obtaining from the Internet.
They do it by an affidavit. Why would that be challengeable?
Well, it should be, we were interested in people in the District of Columbia when we obtained the names. We didn't have any idea of where they were located.
You didn't have any idea?
We did not.
And say again the reason you didn't use geolocation. It's because you don't think it's accurate?
It's not particularly accurate.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it does give you a ballpark figure, but if you put a person, we have experience where it's put one address in two or three different states.
You had no good faith basis for believing that all these people you were asking for information about were in the district.
We had good faith basis to believe the people from whom we were seeking the information did business.
As far as the people about whom you were seeking the information, you had no good faith basis to believe that they were in the district. These are the people you
sue. We had good faith basis to believe
that. 1,000 odd does out here.
We did not sue any of them. I mean, we didn't name anybody individually. We didn't have any information.
You sued somebody. You just called them John Doe. You have not served anybody.
Nor identified anybody.
If you haven't sued somebody, then we're not here. You sued somebody, right?
Right.
You had no reason to believe there was such a suit in the District of Columbia when you sued them. Is that right?
We had a good faith basis to believe that they were infringing on a copyright and that a substantial amount of that occurred in the district.
Actually, your argument in the brief is, since personal jurisdiction can be waived, you could sue 20,000 people all over the country, none of whom are in the District of Columbia, because it would be up to them to decide whether to assert personal jurisdiction. That's your position, isn't it?
I mean, that's theoretically possible.
Wasn't that your position in your brief?
Yes.
Yes, your position is you could sue 20,000 people, none of whom are in the District of Columbia, because every one of those 20,000 people have to assert personal jurisdiction, and they could waive it. That's really your position.
That's a theoretical position, yes.
Theoretical. That was your position in your brief, wasn't it?
That was what was argued in the brief, yes.
Yes.
So when you stood up here, you wanted to talk about joinder. So I'd like to hear your point about joinder. And how is it that you have any basis for thinking that all of these John Does could possibly be joined in one lawsuit?
Because it's in the BitTorrent parlance, it's called a swarm. And in order to participate in it, person participating not only has to download information from other users, but also has to upload information to other users. So it's a collaborative process where piece by piece, people involved in it disassemble and then reassemble a copyright work involving a series of hundreds or thousands of transactions that can sometimes take a substantial period of time. And there has been substantial litigation about how long of a time is a reasonable amount of time, whether it's several weeks or whether it's a short time period. In the Seventh Circuit alone, there were two decisions last year. One Judge Kendall held.
Well, don't tell me about decisions. Okay. So let's assume someone, you have two people. John Doe 1 downloads the video in January 1st, and John Doe 2 does it April 1st. Okay? Now, how can they be joined, those two?
Because they're involved in the same process of downloading and uploading the same.
Well, that's not the same transaction. Right. They're not transacting with each other.
It's the same form.
But how do we know?
That's the concept of how BitTorrent worked. Judge Howell explained it in her opinion and as explained in the testimony at the evidentiary hearing, that you have to participate.
What about Amicus's analogy to the poker game? Would you say in that case that all the participants in that poker game over, say, a 10-hour period were engaged in the same transaction under her hypothetical?
I don't think it's a good hypothetical because it's possible to see.
Don't find the hypothetical.
In BitTorrent,
I thought it was a wonderful hypothetical, frankly.
I mean, it's an inapposite hypothetical.
I thought it would have been better had it been 21 rather than 10.
My understanding is everybody has to interact with everybody else in order for the whole film to be produced.
What do you mean by interact? They don't even know who they're talking to. They're not talking to anybody. They're just using a technology that happens to retrieve something. They have no idea where it's coming from.
They have no idea where it's coming from, but they know they're taking it from somebody and giving it to somebody else, and you can't see the.
Well, you don't even know you're giving it to somebody else.
You can see the IP address numbers on the. You don't know their names. You can, if you're interested, see the numbers.
So if a person puts simply downloading it doesn't make you. If John Doe 1 downloads this video, that's the end of the involvement for John Doe 1, right? His copy of it can't be used by others.
That's correct.
BitTorrent doesn't then use John Doe 1's download, right? You have to put it on the video, onto Comcast for purposes of making it available to other people, correct?
In order to be in BitTorrent, my understanding is you also have to upload it as well. You can't simply just download it.
Yes, that's what I just said. You have to upload it to make it available. Now, once you've done that, is it there permanently, or do you have to... In other words, if I wanted to send someone a video, if I wanted to send Judge Silverman a video, and I upload it, and then he downloads it, is my video there forever, or do I have to do something to make it available for part of the BitTorrent process?
I think you have to do something to remove it. I'm not sure if you have to do something to keep it.
Right,
there.
But the point is how do we know, in my hypothetical of a January 1 and an April 1 download, that they came from the same combination of uploaded videos? Because if they came from different ones, then there's absolutely no basis for joint.
Well, I mean, I think you're getting past my BitTorrent knowledge, but I believe that it does
result
in a discrete product.
Joinder.
Discrete work, rather than a series of works.
So you don't know the answer to my question?
I don't.
Uh-huh. Anything else?
No.
Thank you. Did counsel have any time left?
Yes, Mr. Fox.
Oh, go ahead, Mr. Fox.
Your Honors, joinder.
Yeah, please.
The rule that we are advocating for, and what I think is well supported in the case law and supported by the technology, is that two defendants need to be online at the same time. So when Mr. Duffy is saying you can see the IP addresses, that may be true for someone who is online at the same time as another user. This does away with the 21 subscribers, the 20 Verizon, the 1 Comcast, because he, meaning plaintiff, has the times that each alleged defendant accessed the Internet. There is not overlap.
Do you have that, too?
Yes, it's attached to the complaint.
And there's no, they're all different times?
There are different times and dates over 4 months.
Uh-huh.
And I did my best to parse it.
Yeah.
I don't see overlap. He didn't make any effort and we're arguing for a prima facie evidentiary showing. They did nothing to show online at the same time.
So what's the technical answer to my question? If I upload a video, it then becomes available for BitTorrents, right, to download it to other people who seek it?
Yes. If one uploads the video, right, it is there. There is evidence from other cases that they have uploaded.
And does it stay there?
I believe so.
It does. Uh-huh.
Yes. But, again, to participate, well, it's important to say that the snapshot that they have taken of different Internet subscribers' home addresses accessing the Internet does not show that any one of these defendants or subscribers has downloaded the film, because time is required to do that.
So even if the video stays up there, there's no basis for joinder under your theory, because they have to do it at the same time, right?
Correct. If they
you're saying this is just like claiming that five people who rob the same bank over a period of 4 months can't be joined, right?
Exactly.
That's the same thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And I would just add, Rule 11 requires them to substantiate their claims. It, in my view, is outrageous that Mr. Duffy would stand up here and say, I don't know, when he himself pleaded the fifth in a related case.
What was that again? What did you just say?
That Mr. Duffy, among others, pleaded the Fifth Amendment in response to questions about who was the beneficial owner of AF Holdings and whether the signature was authentic and whether the plaintiff's lawyers uploaded this film.
You get
it.
On the point.
Two questions real quickly.
Yes.
What's your reaction to Mr. Duffy's response to my question about your sentence, about in 118 of his cases, none have been ended up in?
This is not a fact I made up. This is in a declaration filed by AF Holdings, custodian of records, okay, that is in the exhibits at page 103 okay of our appendix.
Okay, thank you. And number two, what's your response? You argued, or you told us in your brief, that the Alan Cooper name on the copyright assignment was forged. And Mr. Duffy's response is, A, he doesn't know whether that's true or not, but B, it doesn't make any difference because the assignee's name isn't essential.
In my mind, this is a Rule 11 issue. Uh-huh. It certainly is relevant to good cause, and had it been known by the district court, it certainly, I believe, would have affected the analysis. And this court has an independent duty to confirm that the documents filed here are authentic.
And is a U.S. attorney in California looking into this forgery? Alleged forgery, excuse me.
I know that it has been referred to the U.S. attorney in the Central District of California. Yeah. They typically do not let us know what they're doing until charges have been filed.
Okay. Anything else?
Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.